The Haftorah for Parshas Chayisara gives us another straight week with Nevi'im Rishonim. It is the very beginning of Melachim Aleph. And essentially, it's going to be the story of Adonia attempting to take over the kingship from David HaMelech. We start off, and David HaMelech is elderly, and Adonia seems to believe that he's going to be able to take over. The notion that David is described as elderly, what you find in the opening pasuk here, that David is Babi Amim, so that language is also in our parsha. That language also describes Avram Avinu. And according to Lavush, that's the connection, that we find both Avram and David described as Babi Amim. And Babi Amim is a phrase which is used as a praise. It's not simply to say somebody is elderly, but it has a connotation that it's a person who has lived a worthy life and has not only had years, but his years have had days. The days have counted. The days have been meaningful. And it's possible, the Medrash comments, possible to have one without the other. One can be elderly and not be credited as being Babi Amim, as having his days being counted as meaningful. And this is something that's said both about Avraham and David. So Lavush writes, that's the connection to the Haftorah. Friend of Ezra Schwartz, Shlita, in his article Mitoch HaOhel, notes that presumably it's more than that. It can't be that that one phrase is the only link here. And he suggests that the rest of the Haftorah is also relevant, because it's not simply that they're both elderly here, David and Avram, but they need to actively work on succession. And that was a belated revelation to both of them, that until the Akedah, Avram was not focused on doing anything to make sure that there would be a taking over of his leadership role. He was involved in chinuch in general to a tremendous degree, but that there should be someone to assume his position, that it wasn't enough to rely on Kadosh Baruch Hu's promise that that's how it's going to happen. In both cases, there needs to be an active succession plan, and perhaps that's what the Haftorah is also drawing a parallel. It's one of the points that Rabbi Schwartz writes in his article. He also adds that there's another parallel here, which is maybe also part of the whole preparation, that in both cases these stories take place right after the star of the story has done something to acquire land in Eretz Yisrael in a very proactive way. So we have in the beginning of Chayisar, of course, Avram obtaining Maris and Machpelah and refusing to take it for free, insisting to pay for it. And so too, in the end of Sefer Shmuel Beis, we have a somewhat parallel story with David HaMelech obtaining the land from Arabna Hayavusi and also insisting on paying for it. So together with this whole preparation for the next stage is also an act of expanding our involvement and our settlement in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so that could be a possible parallel and a linkage between the Parsha and the Haftorah. Just as we begin to say a word about the beginning of Sefer Melachim, which is what this Haftorah is the very opening of Sefer Melachim. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky has a comment that's published in this Emes Yaakov on Nach, that we know Chazal tell us that Melachim was written by Yirmiyahu HaNavi. So you have to wonder, that we know that Yirmiyahu is the Navi of the Churban, so why is it that specifically in the context of the Churban did Yirmiyahu feel it was necessary to write this down? We have a tradition in Chazal that the Nehuos that are written down are necessary for us, that we don't have recordings of every prophecy that ever was, that there was endless prophecy, there's tons of prophecy that we never heard anything about. And Nevuah Shenichtava is because it was Hutzrach HaLadoros, because it has value for the future generations. So why did Yirmiyahu feel at that time he should write down the story of Malachim?
You say Eliyahu
Navi
wrote it?
Yirmiyahu Navi. So why did Yirmiyahu felt that that was a necessary act at that time? So he suggests to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky that here at the time of the Chorban, it's possible for people to be in a state of Yeish and to give up and to think it's all over for them. So therefore, it's important to reconnect us to the grandeur of the monarchy of the Jewish people, what it once was, and specifically the fact that it was always honed in to Hashgacha, that the Kadosh Baruch Hu is guiding the process so overtly, and that our behavior has a big impact. So just as this is true in the historical monarchy of the Jewish people, so too as we anticipate the Geula and we look forward to coming back, so we have to recognize that this intertwining of our behavior and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's response to our behavior is a crucial part of that process. Okay, so to look a little bit at some of the specific psukim here, and also maybe to see how they expand on some themes. So after telling us that David HaMelech was zakein and ba biyamin, so the Navi tells us v'chasuhu ba'begadim v'lo yichamlo. So he was cold, and they would cover him up with clothes, but he still wasn't able to feel warm. He still felt cold. So here there is a comment that Rashi quotes from the Gemara Maseches Brachos and Daf Tamech Beis that this was somehow a punishment to David or some type of payback, because we previously had the story of David secretly cutting off the corner of the coat of Shaul in order to make the point that he could have killed him and didn't, and that was apparently an act of bizayon to the garment, it sounds like. So Rashi quotes the idea that if somebody is mevaza begadim, they're not going to work for him anymore. They're not going to accomplish what they're supposed to on his behalf. I remember many years ago, I was seeing that Rabbi Meir Tzvi Bergman, who was the son-in-law of Rav Shach, has a beautiful svarim on the Parsha and otherwise called Shari Ora. So he commented on what the Rambam writes in Mishneh Torah. What the Rambam talks about learning, and he says that there is a special inyan of learning at night, learning deep into the night, as the president told us, right, that night seder, as you know, has tremendous chashivas, that the night is a time for learning. And the Rambam writes that whoever allows even one night to be wasted in frivolity, he's not going to see hatzlacha in learning. So that's a difficult phrase to understand. I mean, it's one thing to say that the night is a tremendous opportunity for learning, but to say if you lose even one night, then that's it, you're over. So how does that work? I mean, what if this person had lived one day less? He would never have had hatzlacha in learning. What if he had some kind of an onus, that there's some kind of an emergency that stopped him from learning? So then every night is so crucial that if you miss one, there's just no hope of making it up. So he pointed out, the Shari Ora, that it's similar to what we see here, that it's not about that you need all those minutes exactly, and if you lose one night, then that's it, you can never make up those minutes. The point is that the Rambam is saying that night is particularly suited for Talmud Torah, so it's like the kli, it's the utensil that brings about Talmud Torah. And if you're mevaza the kli, not if you happen by circumstance not to have the availability of that night, but if you just throw it away with frivolity, so then you're showing disrespect to the kli. You're showing that you don't care about it, and then you can't expect it to work on your behalf. And he connected it to this idea that Chazal are conveying here about David HaMelech, that if he shows disrespect to clothing, so it's going to end up, the clothing is not going to work for him. If you disregard the kli is not going to have an effect. So he suggests that that's what the Rambam is saying about nighttime. Remember, that's what I say, remember, this is years ago, remember I spoke about this, I think, at the Ofra for Rabbi Roblowski. So if you know Rabbi Roblowski, you know he represents Hasmada and making use of night for learning. So this was a theme that was relevant to speak about at that time. Okay, in any event, so clothing doesn't work for him. So they bring him this young maiden, Avishag, and she is there to provide warmth. And the pasuk tells us that that's what she was doing, but the king was not intimate with her. In pasuk dalet it says, "V'hanayra yofa ad ma'od, v'tihi l'melech sochenes, v'tisharsehu," that she was an attendant for him and she served him, but hamelech lo yada'a, that he was not intimate with her. So the Gemara, Masechet Sanhedrin, and the Chof Beis and Aleph tells us a little bit more of the whole story here, that apparently she asked David to marry her. He said, "You should marry me." And David said, "I can't, because I already have 18 wives. And the rule is the king is not allowed to have too many wives. More than 18 is considered too many. So therefore," he said, "I'm at my limit. I can't marry you." So the Gemara there in Sanhedrin has a fascinating comment. So you see essentially that he had a halachic quandary here, because since he wasn't going to marry her, so it wasn't a Gilei Arayos issue per se, or an Erva Aznus issue per se, because he wasn't intimate with her, but it would seem like it's at least a Yichud issue. So he's alone with her. So he could have saved himself from the Yichud issue by marrying her. But he couldn't do that because he was already at his limit. So he could have divorced one of his wives. But the Gemara says, you see here, that Gerushin is a bigger problem than Yichud. That they were ready to allow the Yichud, but not to allow the Gerushin. So it's fascinating discussion, Bechlal, because you say to be Matir Gerushin, so is there an Isser Gerushin? So apparently, yes. Apparently, to divorce a wife for no reason, that she didn't do anything wrong. He's just interested in some kind of a side issue. That the Gemara is emphasizing that this is not something that we're casual about. That, and then the Gemara has the statement there. It's a famous statement. It's quoted though in this Gemara in this context. That Kol Magarish Isha Rishon Ishta Rishona Afilu Mizbeach Marid Lav Tamos. That whoever divorces his first wife, even the Mizbeach cries. And here it's not even talking about anything close to his first wife. It's talking about the. At least his 18th wife could have been the one. And yet the Gemara is saying that that's not something to be casual about, that she didn't do anything wrong. If there isn't a reason to divorce her, so then that's not going to be the preferred path here, and they were more ready to allow Yichud for his well-being rather than to allow Gerush. Some point out that it's hard to see how this is really a perfect model, because maybe there's a bigger issur as far as the king is concerned, because if he would divorce his wife, she's not allowed to marry anyone else after the king, so he'd really be putting her in a very difficult position. Maybe that's not the same if it was a person who's not a king. His wife could theoretically remarry somebody else, but okay, it's not addressed by the Gemara. It sounds like from the Gemara that that's the emphasis here. Hi.
How are they allowing him to violate Yichud?
Because he's alone with her. So he was stuck in a quandary.
How is that allowed?
That's what the Gemara is telling us, that no one objected, that this was understood to be an acceptable arrangement by everyone who knew about it.
Did he talk about why it was acceptable?
So just that it's acceptable because he needed it for his health, but apparently even though there was another option, he could have divorced one of his wives and married her, that was considered to be a less preferable option. Better to do this than to have him unnecessarily divorce one of his wives.
But we would allow someone to violate Yichud for health?
So it's a good question. Not necessarily, and every case you have to figure out exactly what the details are. So on the Sefer Musar HaNeviim, he comments that, you know, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin that there was a man who fell madly in love or in lust with a certain woman, and he said that I'm going to die unless I can be with her, even if I can just look at her, and they weren't going to allow it. They didn't allow it, even though he said that he was going to die otherwise. So how come it's different here? So as he suggests, and I think this really is Pashup Shat, that the idea that Chazal or the Rabbanim were sometimes very machmir on something, even beyond Pikuach Nefesh, is first of all, an approach that we don't find all the time. It's when it's tzarech hashah, when it's really considered necessary. But the main difference as the Mussar Nevi'im points out, and I think it's clear, is that here the person specifically wants to do the Aveira for the sake of the Aveira. So that kind of religious blackmail, so to speak, to say, I need to do this or else I'm going to die because my desire for the Aveira is so great that I can't live without it. So then we have to say we can't give in to that kind of pressure. So sorry, no matter how badly you think you need it, we have to draw a line here. But here, in this case, David wasn't interested in the yichud per se. He just needed that for the practical benefits that it provided. So then it's simply a question of weighing yichud, which, by the way, in this case, is a mitzvah d'rabbanan, a yichud with a pnuya. So the question of weighing one against the other, that was the understanding that this was less of a problem than gerushin, which also brings up the discussion. You can also find the same from Mussar Nevi'im, that apparently whatever Isser the Gemara is talking about regarding Gerushin must be an Isser D'Rabbanan, it sounds like, because since Yichud is an Isser D'Rabbanan, so if there was an Isser D'Raisa involved, that would have explained it. Okay, so the Gerushin is an Isser D'Raisa, and Yichud, in this case, was an Isser D'Rabbanan. So if that's not the answer, it's ranking Gerushin against Yichud, it must be that they're on at least the same level as far as whether it's a D'Raisa or a D'Rabbanan. But in any event, to have this whole story here about what he was doing with her, what he wasn't doing with her, so one could say that this is too much information. You know, why exactly do we need to know? Why is this b'chavadik? I mean, it was okay, maybe it was legitimate and appropriate, but why is this something that the Navi has to tell us, this whole story? So Rav Rivlin, Shlita's Mashgiach of Karen Biav, and Rav Ram Rivlin, he has a fascinating discussion in his Sefer on the Haftorahs, where he explains the interconnection of all of the things going on here. And he makes the following points. First of all, the Gemara over there in Sanhedrin tells us this detail about what David did and didn't do, because it had a halachic nafkamina, that had he married her, or even been with her, so that would have created an isser for his sons to marry her as a stepmother. But the Gemara points out that it was prohibited for any son other than Shlomo, because Shlomo would have been allowed to marry her, because it wasn't, she didn't have the din of somebody who had been married or had been with the father. That's what the Navi is emphasizing, that that didn't happen. So it wasn't an automatic prohibition to his children, but it was a prohibition to anyone who's not the king. Because since she was a servant of the king, and it's not appropriate for a hedgehog to avail himself of the servant of the king, so therefore for a non-king son, she would have been prohibited. So the Gemara emphasizes that for Adonia she was prohibited, and for Shlomo, not. So Rivlin points out that he thinks this is really the key to the whole story here, that we are told that Adonia wants to marry Abishag, and the understanding we have of that is that he wants to solidify his hold on the monarchy. He wants to show that he is able to take over as king, and therefore he can indeed marry this woman who would have been prohibited to any non-king. So that's how we assume the story is going, that this is an act of strengthening his claim to the kingship. But as the Malbim suggests, and as Rav Rivlin discusses in more detail, that it's actually the other way around. That really he had a tremendous desire for Avishag, and the Navi emphasizes how beautiful she was, and that was really what he was after. But because now she was usher to anyone who wasn't the king, so therefore he had to take himself as king. He had to declare himself as the monarch in order that he could accomplish his real goal, which was to marry Avishag. Now, why did that all come about? So why did Hashgacha have it that such a situation should happen, that this woman should be brought into the palace and that Adonia should fall in love with her and therefore have to rebel in order that he can be able to marry her or declare himself king in order that he could marry her? So, Rivlin notes, he says, that's what we were just talking about the idea, the whole episode with David and Shaul, where he cut the clothing. So that itself is also an act of rebellion. That was David HaMelech essentially defying Shaul, and the clothes represent the melucha. So, yes, it's nice of what we were saying before about being revaz of the kli and the gadim in general, but presumably there's a larger theme here. It's not just that David was disrespectful to clothing, but the clothing specifically represented the melucha, and this was an act of rebellion, essentially. So midah keneged midah, what happens to him is that he ends up having this rebellion from Adonia. So essentially, it's not that the midah keneged midah, the clothes simply don't work for him, but because the clothes don't work for him, that's how Avishai comes into the story. Because Avishai comes into the story, so Adonia wants to marry her. Because he wants to marry her, that's why he rebels. And this is all a situation that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put in midah keneged midah for David's rebellion against Shaul, and that's essentially why the whole Haftorah is connected, why all the parts of the story that we have are all connected to each other. It's not simply that the first four psukim are this random story giving us too much information about David and not connected to the rest. It's all connected. Everything here is all a part of the story, and all of this is Midah Keneged Midah. That's a fascinating interpretation. So in a separate point, he then goes on to discuss a little further of Rivlin, that, okay, having said that, that David HaMelech rebelled against Shaul, and that's why he deserved this. So if you look at the story, it's not really fair to say. I mean, the fact is, David was a tremendous gibor. He had tremendous restraint in how little he rebelled against Shaul, and that everyone was pushing him to do this, and everyone around him was saying, just kill Shaul and take over. And he went very much in the opposite direction. So to say, okay, he deserves all of this because he cut off the baguette, cut off the corner of the baguette, and that was an act of rebellion, so that's why he has to pay this price. So it seems like that's a little bit unfair. After all, he was particularly disciplined in not rebelling against Shaul, particularly restrained. So he goes on to say that this is an example of a Kaddish Baruch Hu Medaktik al Chasidav Kechut HaSaira. We know that we have an idea that comes up often in Nach, that a Kaddish Baruch Hu is particularly exacting when it comes to those who are tzaddikim otherwise, those who are on a very high level. So a Kaddish Baruch Hu is particularly strong with them and really makes sure that they are held to a very high standard. So this is a reflection of that. But the Rivlin also explains a little more than that, that we don't only mean that in terms of individuals, that people who are tzaddikim get held to a higher standard and pay a price even for smaller acts of misbehavior. But we're saying a little more than that, that yes, that could have applied to David also, but we're saying more than that, that not just his overall tzidkus, but the areas that you excel in. So then, when there's a shtickle, a nefila, when there's a shtickle of failure, so then that exacts a price that wouldn't apply to other people. So specifically, because David was so restrained and didn't yield to the pressure to rebel against Shaul, Davka, because of that, that's why the one misstep that he took, the one action that was worthy of criticism, he ended up paying a price for, because that's part of this idea that Kadosh Baruch Hu is very medaktik, both on people who are tzaddikim in general, and also in areas in which a person normally excels, so then he's held to task if he doesn't live up to that standard 100%. Also a fascinating idea. Okay, so to continue to the next pasuk, so here Yaakov Kamenetsky has another whole discussion. It's also just interesting to note, and perhaps this also has a connection to the parsha itself, that so the pasuk tells us that V'adonia v'enchoges misnase lomar ani amloch v'yas l'arech v'farash v'chamish v'nish ratzim l'fanav. So he declared, I will be king. So it's not really clear from the pasuk what's he saying, I will be king eventually. I just want you to know that when David dies, I'm going to be the one who takes over. Or was he saying, I'm going to be king now, even when David is alive? So Rav Yaakov has the whole discussion there that it's not impossible as far as succession of kings are concerned, that even though we talk about one king taking over for his father, in general, it's not a din of Yerusha, like we find otherwise, that specifically once the father passes away, that's when something passes on, when a property passes on to the son. It's not Yerusha in that sense. And he explains that it's about the idea that we find in Sefer Dvarim on Yarech Yamim Amachta Hu Vanav, the care of Yisrael, that there's a chain of the family continuing the monarchy, but it's not like property that is passed on specifically through the normal process of a father dying and the son taking over. So this could happen when the father's alive too. The father can retire and the son can take over as king. And then this, as he points out, see, he points this out, it's all written afterwards anyway, but this is in the Sefer of Rav Yaakov that's published on Nach. So he's not emphasizing that there's any connection to the Parsha and the Haftarah here, but it happens to be in this comment. He cites the Parsha also, so perhaps that's a part of the connection. But that's also really what we find with Avram and Yitzchak, that essentially in Parsha's Chayisara, where you have Yitzchak finding his Shidduch and now building a new family and taking over essentially while Avram is still alive, that's the nature of these things, that it's not property that's only going to transmit from one generation to the next when the father dies, but it's the nature of how leadership goes, and that's essentially what we're finding both in Chayisara and in the beginning of Sefer Melach. A few more ideas here. The next pasuk is very important for chinuch and things like that in general. That the pasuk tells us in a very striking way, "Velo atzavo aviv miyomov." Lemor madua kacha asisa, that his father, that David, had never scolded him, had never said to him, "Why'd you do that?" So apparently, this is cited here right in the middle of his process of rebellion, in order to tell us that one led to the other, and that David HaMelech, with all of his great talents and with all of his great spiritual accomplishments, was not focused on chinuch in the way Avraham Avinu was. As some Svarim draw the contrast very powerfully, that Avraham Avinu is highlighted in the Torah for his chinuch efforts, and David apparently was not willing to ever criticize his son. And you could have thought that the pasuk is just mentioning this in order to highlight that part of the whole rebellion is that, okay, the Adonijah is declaring that I'm the king, and David is not willing to challenge him because that's not what he's going to do. So therefore, Adonijah gets the message. Okay, so I can keep going with this because David is not challenging him. But the pasuk, by emphasizing Miyamav, is telling us that no, it's not about just that he didn't say anything now. It's that his whole life, that is how he was brought up. He never told him that he can't. He never told him that this isn't something he should be doing. And this is what contributed to him being the way he was. And Rashi here has a comment that whoever withholds tochacha from his child, whoever is too afraid to rebuke his child, the result is that he's bringing him towards Misa. That it's not going to work out well for him. It's going to be a very bad result. And that's a part of what we see reflected here. I believe he has the comment, one of the Svarim, I believe it's him, has the comment also that the Lashon of Atzavo, it sounds like it means he never upset him by saying, "Why do you act the way you do?" But it also could be said, Al Pidarach Hadrush, Yitzuv, he didn't form him, he didn't create him, that's a part of what Chinuch requires, that you have to also be able to tell the child that this is not the way to be, and he failed to do that, and therefore this is essentially how he turned out. And as Rav Rivlin also points out, that really the whole pasuk is giving us essentially three reasons why he was moved to this rebellion, in addition to what we said before, that he also had this tremendous taiva for Abishag. But also, the pasuk here is identifying three additional issues. One is that no one ever told him no. No one ever corrected him when he did things that were inappropriate. Two is v'gam hu tov tohar ma'od. He was also very good looking, so he was under the impression, okay, that's all it takes, that I'm very kingly in my appearance, So, therefore, that's something to give me enough stature. And also, Oso Yalda Achrei Avshalom. He was born after Avshalom. So why are we talking about Avshalom here? Why is that mentioned? So he suggests that the mention is for telling us that he was the same age around as Avshalom. He was a contemporary of his. So they hung out together. So he was influenced by him. So just like Avshalom was inclined towards rebellion, so he picked up midos from him. And there is a statement here about the importance of who your friends are, who you hang out with, and that also has it also has an impact. Just to make one or two other comments here. So there is an interesting ha'ara on this pasuk, and that the pasuk tells us pasuk yud aleph. So we find that Nasan ha pasuk yud aleph beis gimel. Pasuk tells us that Nasan Hanavi gets involved here, and he tells Bathsheba that we got to do something about this. The Pasuk Kedal says, "V'yomer Nasan al Bathsheba, Eim Shlomo lemor halo shamat, ki malach Adonio ben Chagis v'Adoneinu David lo yada." So he says to Bathsheba, says, "You must have heard what's going on, that Adonio is acting as king, and David doesn't know what's going on. V'ata l'chi atzeich." Now listen to what I'm saying, that you have to save your own life and the life of your son Shlomo, and you should go and you should tell him, didn't you promise me that Shlomo is going to be the one who's going to take over, and why is it that Adonio is becoming the king? So Nasan HaNavi is pushing Bathsheba into action here, saying that you have to do something about this. So here, it's interesting, Yaakov Kamenetsky has a comment about this also. He says, why is Nasan so worked up about this? So he assumes it's because he was the Navi, he was the one who conveyed the message that Shlomo HaMelech is going to take over. So, okay, so why does that mean he has to get so worked up? So why does that have to be his job to handle this? So, as he explains, a fascinating point is that he sees here that this was Ratzon Hashem, that because he was the messenger, because he was the Navi, so he saw that this was God's will, that Shlomo should take over. And we have a notion in general, which comes up everywhere, that when you know something is Ratzon Hashem, whether or not you have a direct sivui, whether or not you have a direct command, so you have to act to try to bring about Ratzon Hashem. So since he was the one who carried the message, he was the one who knew this, so therefore he was then going to take steps to bring it about and not simply rely on the nevuah, but this was a sense of mitzvah. He was fulfilling a mitzvah by making sure that he could do that, making sure that he could contribute to this happening. So in the next pasuk, and we'll just mention one last idea here. So the next pasuk says, he continues to go on, he says, Hine odach medaberes shama mamelech v'ani avo acharayich umaleisi estivarayich. So while you're still talking, then I'll come in and I'll confirm also what you're saying, and I'll also support you. So the Yerushalmi in Peah has a statement here. At the very beginning of Peah, there's a lot. If you want to start learning Yerushalmi, so Peah is a good choice. First of all, because it's the first Masechta that's the only Yerushalmi. But also, you have a lot of interesting things in the beginning of Peah. It's all on that Mishnah of Eilu Dvarim Shein Lahem Shir. So all of the Gemaras in the Yerushalmi about Lashon Hara are concentrated there. In the Bavli, you want to learn a lot of Lashon Hara. So the middle of Maseches Erechin, there's a lot of statements about Lashon Hara. A few other sugyas and shas, which are very important, but a lot of the statements are concentrated in the middle of Erechin. So in the Yerushalmi, it's the beginning of Peah. So over there, the Yerushalmi says that you see from here, that here you have Nasan Navi saying, I'm going to say some extra stuff about how bad he is. So what he's saying, so apparently it's Mutter L'daber Lashon Hara al balei machlokes. If somebody's a bal machlokes, so it's permissible to say lashon hara about him. The Gemara also derives this from Parshas Korach, because we find there that when Dasan and Aviram refuse to come to Moshe, then they're mechutzafim to the Shliach Bezdin, that apparently the Shliach Bezdin conveyed all this to Moshe Rabbeinu. So apparently, again, says the Yerushalmi, that it's mutter ledaber lashon hara al bali machlokes. So it's a couple of fascinating points about this, just to mention one or two quickly, that the Chafetz Chaim emphasizes that this is a toeles-based idea, that this is so that you can accomplish the goal of quieting the machlokes. So in order to keep the machlokes to a minimum, or to stop it, that's why it's permissible to talk about the bali machlokes. But anything beyond that, you can't do, and he's very careful about this. He says we shouldn't be quick to label someone a bal machlokes. It's a very limited heter. It's a whole discussion whether the Rishonim recognizes heter to begin with, and that's a whole back and forth. But the Chafetz Chaim says, in any event, this isn't something that we should be too quick to do, and it's only lahashgit to some machlokes. It's only to quiet it down, but we're not allowed to do anything more than necessary. And others had a different approach, like the Netziv, in his commentary to the Sheoltas. He wrote that this is a heter of Russia, that since to be a bal machlokes is an avera, the Torah also in Parshas Korach tells us that we're not allowed to be like Korach, and the Gemara says in the end of Sanhedrin of Daf Kuf Yud, they call him machzik b'machlokes over balav, that there is an avera in being a bal machlokes. So it's essentially the person is a Russia. He says, so that's why there's a heter to speak lashon hara about him. It's not necessarily limited to the specific toeles of quieting him down. It's a broader heter. So why did the Chafetz Chaim not take that position? So I think the Chafetz Chaim himself spells this out, but the idea seems to be that the Chafetz Chaim understood that the Isser Machlokes is an unusual kind of avera. That yes, it is an aveira, that's what the Gemara is saying, and if that's not the source, that's the whole discussion of the Rishonim, whether they count that source of not being like Korach. But if not that, there are a number of other sources in the Torah and in the Nach telling us about the danger and the prohibition of being a bal machlokes. So yes, it is an aveira, but Chafetz Chaim understood that it's a unique kind of an aveira. It's an avera that by its nature, the person who is perpetrating it thinks he's doing the right thing. That's why he's a bal machlokes, because he believes that he is doing what needs to be done. And still, it's an avera nonetheless. So therefore, we can't treat him like an avarian in any other area, because it has this unique trait to it that by its very nature, the person who is engaging in it believes that he's doing the right thing. One could question that a little bit, because you know, certainly there are bali machlokes who are well aware that they are not really helping things, and that they're not really acting completely lishma, and that they have ulterior motives. So it's a good question if it's always true that everyone who is violating this avera is doing it out of the misguided belief that they're doing what they have to do. But it's a powerful statement one way or another, especially in our highly polarized times. To be aware of just how careful we have to be about engaging in machlokas that gets personal, and the machlokas that may seem like it's necessary but actually can stray from what is really lishma and what is really accomplishing anything justified. And it's a pretty powerful statement. Hi.
How does that, is that related on like the idea of like showkeeping basically? Because like, you're saying that he's someone that thinks he's doing the right thing, which means he's not. Would you kind of say that he's unaware he's doing the wrong thing?
I think he's making the point that it's a different kind of thing, though, because when you have shogeg or mezid, so then you always have that possibility a person's not aware that what he's doing is wrong. But he's saying that the nature of the action built into it is a misguided belief that it's necessary when it isn't, and it's still prohibited even in that case. So that's where the uniqueness comes in, that its very nature is misassessing how something is needed. And perhaps that is a unique kind of application. And again, I think that is a very timely message, especially at a time when achdus is more necessary and the need for unity has been highlighted to such a great extent. And nonetheless, we tend to take it as a reason to attack each other all the more. So to be reminded of just how powerful a force l'ra machlokas is, and just how easy it is to be misled and to think that you're doing what needs to be done, and that may very much not be the case, that is a pretty powerful statement. Just to add one more insight on this topic, that the Chassam Sofer and his Chidushim to Moed Katan, this comes up also in a Gemara in Moed Katan, which talks about the heter for a shliach bezdin to relate back to the bezdin what happened. So many achronim ask, well, we're talking about dasan and avirim, so it's bali machlokas anyway, so why can't you go to that heter rather than say that it's about the shliach bezdin? So Chassam Sofer has a comment there. There are many different explanations as to why that needed its own svara, and it wasn't just based on the Baal Machlokas idea. So, the Chassam Sofer, in his Chidushim to Moed Katan, writes that regarding the heter of Baal Machlokas, he says it's only one time, it's not an ongoing thing that you can consistently speak badly about them. He says you can only say it once to convey the message that this person is Baal Machlokas, but he has a fascinating addition of one word which changes the whole context. It says Baal Machlokas Shelo, meaning this is somebody who's in a dispute with you. So presumably his point is that sometimes a person is behaving a certain way, it's necessary for you to give some context to what he's doing and say, listen, there's an animosity here, there's a grudge, and that's skewing this person's behavior, and you shouldn't read into it more than that. So that's how the Chassam Sofer understands the concept, that it's permissible to identify somebody as your Baal Machlokas. But once that's clear, so then it's not a heter to do other things to disparage this person. And that's one of the suggestions that's offered, why the Gemara has to make both points, that the Yerushalmi is saying that it's mutter to speak about Baal Machlokas, and the Gemara Moed Katan is saying we have another svari here, that it's mutter to tell the Bezdin, the Shliach can tell the Bezdin what was said to them. Just a ha'ara on that, and we'll close. That concept, which already we're never kind of on a tangent, it's a connection, built on a connection, but just that idea of being able to tell the Bezdin what was said to them. So Rav Huttner, in one of his letters, I believe, Rav Huttner has a different understanding of that, that it's not because of something like the Baal Machlokas component, but he says that this is a example of a much broader idea, that when you have an institution like Beis Din, so it's necessary for the Beis Din to know what's going on in order to function. So when somebody works for the Beis Din and they're going to talk about what's going on, you shouldn't think that that's prohibited as far as Lashon Hara is concerned. And that has ramifications, because there's a big discussion in general. Let's say if you have a student who's misbehaving, so the principal wants to write a letter home to the parents about how the student is misbehaving, so is he allowed to ask his secretary to write up the letter? Because is that a Lashon Hara problem, that why should this extraneous individual be involved in knowing what's going on? Maybe the principal should write the letter himself. He shouldn't involve any extra person in the negativity here. So that was a machlokas. It's a machlokas that poskim in the last generation. That Sitz Eliezer has a tshuva. He's talking about a slightly different scenario. He's talking about doctors writing up reports of their students. But he says that you're allowed to have secretaries and other people involved in your system being a part of this, because he has a number of reasons. He says people understand that that's what they're entering into with systems, and that in order to have functionality, you need to have people who have roles like this, and that's not an aveira of Lashon Hara. And that's essentially what Rav Huttner is saying about this passage, a similar idea that that's how the Beis Din functions. That's not called Lashon Hara. It happens to be, though, in this case, with the doctors writing evaluations of their students, Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein quotes in one of his svarim that he asked his father-in-law, Rav Yashuv, about this. Rav Yashuv was actually very machmir. He did not allow it. He thought that there was still a problem of Lashon Hara to have anybody in between writing the negative reports. And they asked him, what if they would leave the names out till the end? You just have the secretary write up all the words, and then the doctor himself would come in and add the names. And he thought that was still a problem. He said, maybe they'll figure out who it is. He didn't allow it at all. He was very machmir about that. But many disagreed. That's what the Tzitzliezer wrote in his Chuvus, and that's what Futner understands, that this idea of that the Shliach Bezdin can report back to the Bezdin. But that's part of the question. So is that necessary, considering that those in the Virum are Bali Machloka? So that's how that whole discussion comes about. All right, we have to be very careful to not be Bali Machloka. We have to be very careful to understand just how much our motives can get mixed. That's really one of the main messages of this Haftorah, that people can have all kinds of claims of nobility and necessity, but lamaisa, there are all kinds of ulterior motives that get interwoven, and particularly in areas of shalom and machlokas, we have to be very, very careful and understand the tremendous emphasis that's put on shalom. And as much as we're convinced that this is what the moment needs for me to be a big bal machlokas, very often it's a misguided conclusion. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu should bless us all with shalom, with good health. Wish everyone a wonderful Shabbos. God willing, on Sunday, I believe we said 11:30, around then, we will start with our Chazar. Good Shabbos. All right. So I guess we'll go downstairs.